Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a local author discusses his new book on the Battle of Saratoga and how it changed the American Revolution. But up front, a record-setting second surge of COVID-19 is devastating India right now. For the past 2 weeks, there have been around 400,000 new cases identified each day and 3,500 deaths. Only 2% of the nation's 1.4 billion people have been fully vaccinated. As a result, India has a shortage of beds, oxygen, and medical workers. Some 4 million people of Indian descent live in the United States, including thousands here in central Pennsylvania. Many of them are trying to get accurate information and provide help to loved ones in India. Joining us today, Deep Gupta is board chair of the Asian Indian Americans of Central Pennsylvania, and board member Deep Anchor Tiwari also joins us. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, and we are happy to be here, Scott.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for inviting us to talk about it.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm going to ask each of you this question. Have you been in contact with family and friends in India, and what are they telling you? Mr. Gupta, let me start with you.
Yes, we have been in contact on a daily basis. Sometimes it is 2 to 3 times a day with families and friends. Yes, things are a little bit quite sad when local community members lose their family members. For us, even if we lose a body, we are very upset and we are very sad. So yes, things are, under control till first week of April, but then suddenly they exploded, the cases exploded. That's all. Deepankar, you want to add something, young man?
Right. So thank you. I think at this point in time, there are very few families that would not be touched by directly or indirectly knowing. This is something in stark contrast with what we faced in the first bout of infections in India or globally. I think we didn't had too many contacts that we could recognize or we could identify. But now I think the situation has just turned upside down, and you're seeing that every family member knows a person or has a person who is dealing with that infection at this point. Can it be a viral strain, which WHO has declared a strain of concern? It is being talked about that it can be a little bit more contagious. So I think, again, those are the facts on the ground at this point in time.
Dr. Tiwari, something you just mentioned, wanted to talk about. India was one of the nations around the world that last spring in 2020, there was the initial bout of the initial surge of COVID-19. But India handled it pretty well. One of the reasons that's being pointed to that it was handled pretty well is that there was a nationwide lockdown. And I mean, nothing like we've seen here in the United States. I mean, this was a lockdown. And this second surge is much more devastating, many more people being hit. And one of the reasons that people are pointing to why it has spread so quickly, maybe that variant that you're talking about, but also that the government has been slow to react to this. Is that one of the things you're hearing from those back in India?
I would respond to that, Scott. Yes, that is true. We are hearing that. But remember, in a democratic country, when last year the prime minister installed a lockdown, there was so much wide criticism. Just like we have here in U.S., We don't know what a state to do, what a state is doing what. Are we open or we are closed? So the same thing is happening in India. But remember also the size of population. We are 333 million versus 1.35 billion people. And the density of population is so high. And we used to be wondering ourselves that what was happening last year, we thought that at one point it is going to explode. And Deepankar, you want to add something, please?
I think you covered it. The problem that I see is we have a 1 billion population. And it's a lot of people. When you consider what the magnitude we're dealing with. And they in many bigger cities, we noticed that in New York last year, in many bigger cities, when density of population is huge, that is a major problem to deal with. If everyone shows up to the hospital, the resources quickly dry up, and that we learned pretty much from the first surge. So I think, again, with the magnitude of infection and the number of people needing help, I think it's just extraordinary at this point. And I think, again, the government, as you pointed out, is it slow in responding? Certainly, they're doing all what they can do at this point with the resources that are available in their hands. But I think it is important that everyone pitches in this fight to fight the virus.
And we're going to talk about that. Dr. Tewari, you mentioned that density, that population density, with 1.35 billion people, but living close together, especially in the urban areas, makes it much easier for this to spread. I want to get back to people that you know and people in your organization, the Asian Indian Americans of Central Pennsylvania. From what I understand, that almost every member of your organization knows someone, is related to someone in India who has contracted the virus. And I don't know about deaths, but that everyone knows someone who has contracted the virus. Is that true?
I would say that, yes, that is true. Definitely, we talk to our people a few times a day. And that is true that every one of them, including myself, including Deepankar Tewari, his father himself is in, he contracted this virus. His uncle contracted, my niece and nephew, they contracted, but with God's grace, they all are back and they are all recovering. But yes, that is true. Particularly, see, in my case, most of my people live in big cities, urban areas, not in rural areas. Deepankar?
Yeah, in my case, I think I had some losses in family and we're contending with that. But I think it's just a reminder that the disease presentation can be very different. There are many asymptomatics in this disease, and that leads to further expansion of the infection. So it's, I think, kind of critical at this point that there is a lot of testing available, quarantines and lockdowns. I think that would drive the surge to lower numbers. There were encouraging numbers just reported yesterday, but I think, again, what's needed is a more stringent lockdown, it's driven by economic parameters and many others that we learned last year from experience here that it could have a devastation on the economy too. So I think they're trying to deal and balance the needs of common man and also the damage it causes to health and survivability of people. So I think it's a very tricky situation, and no country should have to deal with what India is dealing right now.
So what are the most significant challenges that you're hearing that the people of India are facing right now? You mentioned testing, you mentioned quarantines, but what are the biggest challenges that you're hearing that the people are facing right now?
Dipankar, go ahead.
So I think the important thing is access to the medical care. Many of us knew that suddenly the need for oxygen was there and there was a shortage. A lot of help was rushed in. So I think they're slowly building it back. But I think, again, if you have significant population, even 1% population needing oxygen help, those cylinders, those supplies, those concentrators are difficult to come by. Many of the people living abroad are trying to help out with the money, resources, and trying to get those units to the needy. And it's going to be a slow process. So I think, is it going to cause more deaths? I think that's something that we have to be very careful as we move forward. Deepji, you?
Yes, I want to add, you know, for me, the biggest challenge is to change population attitude. They need to understand that this thing is very dangerous. I see people walking outside, just like here also, we see people walking without masks. Last year, we used to fight that issue that, hey, please don't get out, don't go to the grocery store, you know. In India, it is worse because a person, everybody don't have refrigerators at home. So they have to get milk and bread and vegetables every day from the market. And if they have to do it, that means they are getting out of their house. So the overall economic structure, population, and attitude. For me, the biggest thing is attitude. Yes, the government and foreign help can help in supplying medicals and whatever the needs are, but we cannot change attitudes of the people.
Talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the COVID-19 surge in India right now, which is just devastating the nation. As our guest mentioned, there has been, in the last couple of days, a reduction in the number of cases, but they still are very high. Joining us today, Deep Gupta, who is board chair of the Asian Indian Americans of Central Pennsylvania, and board member Dr. Deepankar Tiwari. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Tiwari, I wanted to follow up when you were talking about oxygen, and we were talking about some of the challenges. You know, this is something that early on in the pandemic last year, India was sending a lot of equipment, a lot of aid to other nations around the world, including here in the United States. But here we are in a situation where India is in desperate need of oxygen. How did it get to that point?
I think what I would say is you have to be best prepared, right, for any contingency. And I think, again, that planning takes years and years of making sure we have everything. I would say this, that India is still not the developed country to the standards to match United States. They have done very well economically and overall. But I think in order to build that infrastructure, much investment is still needed. It's needed in every country to build that infrastructure. We just do not have that level of planning in place if everybody shows to hospital even here. We realized that in New York and New Jersey last year. So I think, again, when you are supposed to take care of 1.3 billion people, I think the governments, whatever political affiliations they be, they have to be thinking about, if we get past this pandemic safe and sound, we have to think about how we can cover and be safe from the next one. And the next one would come. So this one came around 100 years after the 1918 pandemic. And with the changes these viruses undergo, I'm pretty sure that there would be another one in 100 years, if not sooner. So I think the problem that we see and I see is there is not enough infrastructure in place to take care of everyone. And that has to be a systemic investment from the governments to really shore up and that cannot happen just overnight. You have to continue to work on it to improve that access for everyone.
Scott, I will add a little more to that. Yes, India, even today, India does produce enough oxygen, but the producing plants and distribution of those in highly controlled atmosphere is not available to transfer to various places. They need a big containers on the train. So these days, the easiest thing is, which we are all trying to help, is those, was that 5-liter canister, Tiwari? So everybody is sending those 5-liter oxygen canisters, which can be connected, you know, just take it in your hand and connect to 4 to 6 people at one time. No country, doesn't matter US or India or any other democratic country, can tolerate, can have this type of problem solved in a short time. Unless you are a country like China, they say absolutely nothing moves from this line to that line. Nobody flies, nobody's, you know. So in a democratic country, when you have to meet with politics, I remember last year, one of the chief minister of India said, okay, I'm not going to take this vaccine produced by this opposition government. And the same attitude we have here. So many people say, oh no, we are not going to take this vaccination. I think even on frontline staff, there are at least between 20 to 30% people working in medical facilities who are not taking vaccination. So that attitude needs to change. And people they need to be selfish. They need to think that, hey, fine, I am fine, I got double vaccination, or if I'm not taking vaccination, how it is going to impact a person across from me or a person in my neighborhood? So they are being selfish by not taking vaccination themselves. Their attitude needs to change. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Scott.
So the oxygen is at a premium, and what you had said, Gupta, Mr. Gupta, about sending canisters from here in the United States to India. By the way, what do they cost? I'm curious as to what they cost here in the U.S.
Each canister is costing about between $450 to $500. Okay. And the big problem was that initially the U.S. administration, I'm not going to say that Biden administration or what administration, they stopped exporting anything like that. But now they have opened, because we have a facility, I believe in Lancaster, who manufacture that. But when we have to go, we have to order through a organization called Seva International, who has 200 chapters in India. We gave our money to them. They have to go and buy them and get them delivered from China.
So you're buying them from China.
I tell you, with all the good regards, last year the government of India did not hesitate for 1 minute. As soon as they heard that this thing they can supply to US, they did. On the other hand, our administration was too slow. Initially, they say, oh, well, we have to take care of our people first, which is true. But, you know, sometimes it is that even if you cannot give somebody what they need, talk little nice. So I was little bit, but now with the pressure the administration got from people, from Congress, from legislators, from senators, they opened up and they, yes, we will do it. And they have been, and we have been doing the U.S. administration now are there to help whatever they can.
Dr. Tewari,
initial response was very slow. That's all.
Yeah, well, kind of like here in this country, too. Dr. Tewari, I want to talk a little bit more about the healthcare system in India. We have heard that beds, that is a real issue. We've heard many stories over the past few weeks about people who have driven hours to try to find a hospital bed. How would you describe India's healthcare system? I mean, I've heard some people say it's the haves and the have-nots who will maybe get a bed, maybe not.
I mean, certainly, I think you're correct that there is a challenge at this time. So the virus does not discriminate between the haves and have-nots. And I think, again, it doesn't matter whether you're in a hospital or not. I think it's not differentiating. But access to medical care should be for everyone, right? That's the goal. At this point in time, the best advice, I think, what the government there and we were here giving, that unless your condition deteriorates to a level where you do need hospitalization, because I think there is a lot of fear with the virus, too, that if you get struck, should you be in the hospital right away? I think they're advising that you can do some level of home health care where you can be managed remotely. And then when the situation becomes critical, initially the access was very poor. Now it's a little bit opening up. Is it there for everyone or a common man? Certainly not. And those are challenges, I think, just abound. But what we do hear that what is the infection level overall and what is the death rate? I think certainly we don't want anyone to be impacted, but I think again we'll have to monitor those trends. Deepji, you have something to add to this?
Yeah, when you are talking, see, how can the global healthcare facilities be evenly distributed for 7.5 billion people? Take example, and when you are a developing country or undeveloped country, that is just impossible. When we take developed countries, superpowers, they don't have that facility. If I go to northern counties in Pennsylvania, the closest hospital is 50 miles or 60 miles. So that is just impossible. If everybody in Harrisburg area, you know, if everybody come to hospital at the same time, last year, there were times when in Holy Spirit and UPMC, we did not have beds for people. And look at the size of the small population. When you compare that size of population in Delhi or Mumbai or any other big cities, yes, doesn't matter what, you will not be able to cover 100 or 60 or 80% of the population. But that said, government of India needs to concentrate more now and in future to care in future how they can help in healthcare facilities, how they can improve healthcare facilities. That is granted, that need to be done.
So we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what do you want our listeners to know? Is there a way that they can help? I mean, we're still dealing with a pandemic in this country. It appears that we've turned a corner, but we know there are a lot of Americans who probably would like to help those in India. What message would you like to leave with our listeners, and what can they do to help?
There are two things. first of all, for our own sake, living here in the United States, I would request all listeners that please follow CDC guidelines, take vaccination, continue to wear masks, and follow whatever else is needed to have a safe life for ourselves. That's number one for ourselves. Regarding what they can do to help India, we have been sending, we have not sent money through government channels, because, you know, when we send money through government channels, it goes there, it sits there, and then it takes time. So there are two foundations which have been working with India, in India, for last 40 years. One is called Seva International, who have their head office in Texas and a big branch office in New York. And then API, which is for Asian Indian medical practitioners. So we have been donating our money through them, because they are buying it directly from China or manufacturers in US and supplying in thousands. UPS has been very, very cooperative in this. Government of India's office in New York, Consulate General's office and embassies, they are very, very much involved in that. And our local community, we have done a fantastic job. I'm not taking any credit for that, but this is the whole community. On a daily basis, they have been talking to people, advising people in India that something like that happens, what do you do? Something like that happens. Because we have over 500, plus minus 500 Asian Indian physicians in this area alone. And they are all wonderful people. They are all trying to help everybody they can. So with the local community, the first thing is, please follow our own safe guidelines. Because I was reading early this morning, I got the news that there are some other countries who are already starting to see the second wave of COVID. A small country like Seychelles and what is that other country, Dipankar, a small island country near between India and Africa, very popular for tourists. The population is only about 1 million, the total island. So they are, so I'm very much concerned that if we here don't practice social distancing, mask and vaccination, we might get hit. And my request to government is that please control, direct people who are traveling from overseas, test them, and if they find something, mandatorily put them in quarantine for 14 days. Particularly people who are coming from the world where it is already a big problem.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Deep Gupta is board chair of the Asian Indian Americans of Central Pennsylvania and board member. Dr. Deepankar Tiwari, thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Local author Kevin Weddle, who teaches at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, has written about the American Army and militias that overcame superior forces and several defeats to rally and change the course of the war in New York State and in the war for independence itself. The book is The Complete Victory, Saratoga and the American Revolution, and we're joined by Dr. Kevin Weddle, Professor of Military Theory and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College. Dr. Weddle, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. Really happy to be here.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Dr. Weddle, you make the case that Saratoga was one of, if not the most important battle or campaign in the American Revolution. Why?
Well, there's several different reasons. I mean, there were some short-term impacts from the Saratoga campaign and some long-term impacts. And, you know, the short-term ones are sort of the obvious ones. There were two major British armies in North America during the American Revolution, during this period of the American Revolution. And at a stroke, at the end of this campaign, the British lose one of them. So that's a big impact right there. It increased American morale, boosted American morale when they really, really needed it. Because if you remember your American Revolution, at the end of 1776, the American Continental Army was basically coming apart. Washington is able to stop the bleeding a little bit with the battles of Trenton and Princeton, but still the Americans were really on the ropes in 1777, and the British were looking for a war-winning strategy in 1777, and the Saratoga campaign was one of these. So the Americans are able to stop that. They're able to seize, actually eliminate one of the two British armies in North America. So all those things are very important, and the morale and all that. But for the long-term implications, it was even more important, because what the Saratoga campaign did is it convinced the French to come in on our side in an overt manner and recognize American independence. And now at the end of the Saratoga campaign, in the aftermath of the Saratoga campaign, the British were now faced with what they really wanted to avoid, and that was a wider conflict. And so after the Saratoga campaign, with the French coming in, and then ultimately Spain would also come in on the American side, the British are essentially looking at almost a global conflict, when before that time, it was really just that small regional conflict in North America. So huge impact. And when you think about how the American Revolution played out with the final campaign at Yorktown in 1781, there, you know, I would argue that there really couldn't have been a Yorktown without a Saratoga.
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. I mentioned in the introduction, though, that most of the history that is taught in school or even books about the American Revolution tend to focus on the main Continental Army led by George Washington. Why doesn't Saratoga get the attention that you think it deserves?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It has gotten some attention. There was a famous book written by a British historian called the, I'm trying to remember the exact title, something like the 50 greatest, most important battles in world history. And he has Saratoga as one of those battles. And there have been some really good things written about Saratoga in the past, but you're right. I think part of it is it took place in upstate New York, in the wilderness of New York. It didn't have the cachet, of course, of having been commanded and controlled or won by George Washington. So all of those things, I think, play into it. But clearly, I think most historians recognize it as being very, very important.
All right. So you talked a little bit about the background, that the British had two main armies. This was the Northern Army coming from Canada, led by British General John Burgoyne. It's the campaign of 1777. What was the plan?
Well, the plan was actually pretty imaginative and but probably a little overly complex for the 18th century. So in June of 1777, two British armies are going to invade New York from Canada. One was the large one that you just mentioned under Lieutenant General John Burgoyne. Their job was to come south along Lake Champlain, capture the American fortress at Fort Ticonderoga, and then continue down the Hudson River to Albany. And there it would meet with a smaller British force, which was also coming down from Canada. They would go down the Mohawk River, which is in western New York State, come down the Mohawk River, also meeting at Albany. So they would be basically a supporting or a diversionary army coming down the Mohawk. And then the plan called for the main British Army under the command of the Commander-in-Chief, General Sir William Howe, coming up from New York City up the Hudson, and there all three of those columns would meet near Albany. And then they would conduct some unspecified follow-on operations in New England. The idea was that they would split the more, by seizing that Hudson River corridor, they would split the more rebellious New England colonies away from the what they thought were the less rebellious middle colonies and southern colonies. But it didn't go according to Burgoyne's plan.
Well, okay, so that's one of the keys to this whole thing, is that Sir William Howe was the British commander in chief in the colonies. I won't say he made it clear, because he didn't, and we'll talk about those communications in just a moment, but even though that was the plan sent from England, and that's what Burgoyne thought was going to happen, that there was to be this meeting of the armies and they would split the colonies, Howe told everyone who would listen, even though he didn't make it clear to Burgoyne, or at least Burgoyne didn't understand, that he wanted Philadelphia. He wanted the colony's capital of Philadelphia, and that really he had no plans to meet up with Burgoyne and split the colonies. How did that miscommunication happen? How did Burgoyne kept thinking this entire time that he was going to meet up with Howe?
Right. Well, you've hit on the key to this whole thing. And that is the development of British strategy. And so it started in late 76, early 77, when the British realized that this wasn't going to be just a quick fix. The revolution was going to go away, that the Americans were pretty serious about this, and they wanted to end this all in 1777. So the idea was, come up with this strategy. Now, Burgoyne is in London at the time, and he's able to press his plan to the king and Lord George Germain, who was the minister in charge of basically running the war effort in North America. So he presents this plan, the three-column plan that I just mentioned. Howe, the commander-in-chief, is sitting in New York City, 3,000 miles away, and in the 18th century, it would take a long time for messages to go back and forth, sometimes as long as 3 months, for a message to go from London to New York City and then a reply coming back. So it's very hard to coordinate a strategy when you have a situation like this. So Burgoyne presents his plan. Howe presents his own plan. His plan, as you just mentioned, was, I want to go to Philadelphia. He actually has several versions of this, but he ultimately decides on, I want to go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the capital, the nominal capital of the new United States, because that's the seat of Congress. And that he assumes Washington will have to defend Philadelphia. And when Washington does this, Howe can have a decisive battle, defeat Washington, defeat the American main army, and thus end the war. Because by this time, Howe had recognized, and I think he was right, that the entire center of gravity of the American Revolution rested on Washington and that main Continental Army. And if he could defeat, hopefully destroy, the main American army, that he would win the war. So you have these two competing plans. And because of that tyranny of distance that I talk about in the book, those 3,000 miles, it's really hard for Germain, who's responsible for coordinating strategy, to come up with a coordinated, coherent strategy that everybody understands and that everybody is sort of pulling the rope in the same direction. And that doesn't happen. I try to go to great pains in the book to explain how this miscommunication takes place. But the sort of the bottom line is, Germain sort of splits the difference, and Germain and King George III basically approve Burgoyne's plan. They also approve Howe's plan, with the proviso that once Howe takes Philadelphia, defeats Washington, that he would then go assist Burgoyne. The problem with all that is all these things take time. And there was a major misunderstanding, I think, in London of how long all these campaigns would take to actually execute. Once Howe recognizes that, once Howe gets the word that his plan has been approved, he does send a message to Burgoyne, who by that time is in Canada, getting ready to preparing his army to come south. He does send a message to Burgoyne saying, hey, General Burgoyne, don't count on me coming up to Albany because I'm probably going to be focused on Philadelphia. So Burgoyne does have some inkling that Howe is not going to be coming up the Hudson. But all of that I just described led to all of this confusion and sort of a muddled British strategy in 1777. And almost everything that happens in that campaign leading to the two final battles of Saratoga can be traced back to that uncoordinated, muddled, really poor strategy.
One of the things I always find fascinating, the behind the scenes, I mean, we're talking about human beings. You just described how the British weren't on the same page, but they also, you write in the book about how many of them didn't like each other, that they didn't get along, and it actually may have been a factor in the plan's failure. So let's talk about some of the actions that occurred that led to Saratoga. Fort Ticonderoga, you mentioned Ticonderoga. It was a huge loss for Americans, but it may have contributed to the British ultimate defeat because of overconfidence. Talk a little bit about Ticonderoga.
Sure. So Ticonderoga is, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been there, Ticonderoga basically guards this famous invasion route from Canada or from or from America up into Canada. And it guides, or it's right on where Lake Champlain kind of butts up against Lake George. So it's in a perfect location to sort of block that invasion route from Canada. So when Burgoyne comes up with his plan, he thought that probably the toughest part of his campaign would be seizing the American fortress at Fort Ticonderoga. But once he did that, he thought it'd be clear sailing to Albany with really no problem at all. But when he arrives at Ticonderoga, there was a series of American blunders. There's some chain of command blunders. Who's supposed to be in command of the Northern Department? Are there enough resources going to Fort Ticonderoga to make sure that it's properly defended and manned? Really, a lot of American blunders led to a fort that wasn't very well prepared to receive an enemy attack, and some commanders there at Fort Ticonderoga that, frankly, were just not the best American commanders. And so when Burgoyne arrives at Ticonderoga and he thinks he's going to have to do a prolonged siege of Ticonderoga before he can finally seize it and get past Ticonderoga, the Americans, after a short 3 day or so period where Burgoyne will sort of maneuver his forces to place the Americans at a great disadvantage, to include putting artillery up on a mountain called Mount Defiance, overlooking the fort that the Americans thought no one could mount artillery on, but the British do. Basically, Burgoyne forces the Americans to retreat and evacuate the fortress, which they do in a very poor, uncoordinated, unplanned manner. The Americans will retreat out of Fort Ticonderoga, and really Burgoyne is able to seize the fort almost without firing a shot. This led to, as you mentioned, this led to Burgoyne's overconfidence. He's also already a very confident kind of arrogant, a little bit pompous. And so this just feeds his overconfidence and feeds his hubris, I think, which is going to lead to some problems down the road.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the conditions that the British faced. The British had Germans and Native Americans, Indians on their side. Burgoyne had an issue with a lot of the Indians that at that time were very violent and wanted to take revenge on a lot of the colonists. The British didn't seem prepared for the conditions. It rained often. There were insects they complained about constantly. The heat and humidity during the summer of 1777. I mean, you can almost make the case, and I think you do, that the humidity that we curse every summer was a factor in our freedom today. So all those things, the British were really, I don't know about morale, but they complained often and didn't seem prepared to be fighting a long campaign in the American wilderness.
Right. Some of their senior officers had fought in that area during the French and Indian War, but most of the soldiers had not. In fact, many of the American units had more combat experience than these very experienced, or I shouldn't say experienced, but very well-trained regular British soldiers. And so they hadn't experienced this extended campaigning in the wilderness of North America. And the other problem that you alluded to there is Burgoyne leaves Canada without all the logistics he needed, all the transport he needed, all the supplies he needed, because he thought once he moved into New York, that the loyalists, there'd be so many loyalists in that area, so many pro-British Americans in that area, that he'd be able to make up his logistics shortfall once he got down into that part of New York. As it turned out, that assumption was wrong, and he didn't get this massive turnout of support that he thought he'd get, and that also exacerbated his other problems.
I hate to say that we have to reduce this great battle to 3 minutes, but that's about how much time we have left. I mean, there's so many good. Benedict Arnold, who has become a villain in American history, was a hero at Saratoga. Horatio Gates, the commanding general at Saratoga, or for the Americans at that time. So what happened in those two battles of Saratoga that the Americans won in 2 minutes or less?
Right. Well, both of these battles took place with Burgoyne trying to get past the American army and get on to Albany, because he thought he had no other choice based on his orders. The Americans were able to seize high terrain, seize the proper terrain, dig in, and both Arnold and Gates managed the army very, very well during those two key battles, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, takes place on the 19th of September, and then the Battle of Bemis Heights that takes place on the 7th of October. And they're able to basically inflict very heavy casualties on the British in both battles. And in the second battle is when Benedict Arnold really shows his personal bravery, leading from the front. They're able to outflank the British army, force Burgoyne's, by this time, exhausted and starving army to retreat north, and they grind to a halt near a place called Saratoga, present-day Schuylerville, New York, where they're quickly surrounded by the Americans, American army, which has now swelled to a size of about 17,000 soldiers because of the massive influx of militia. British are surrounded at Saratoga and forced to surrender. So that's a very, very quick quick and dirty discussion of those.
I wish we didn't have to reduce it to that, but so many great characters and so much. I mean, as you say, that the impact of the victory at Saratoga is even being felt today. But as you mentioned early on, the immediate impact was the French becoming allies with the U.S. British in 1778, deciding that they couldn't fight a land war, or at least put an emphasis on the land war. But fascinating story. Dr. Kevin Weddle, the book is The Complete Victory, Saratoga and the American Revolution. Dr. Weddle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks a lot, Scott. I really appreciate it.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.